Court will now call Texas Health Harris Methodist et al. versus William Austin Biggers. May it please the court, Mr. John Peter Wright to argue first, to argue second for 4 minutes. Mr. Grant Blaine to argue first for 7 minutes. And Mr. Timothy Reynolds to argue third for 4 minutes. To represent the appellant. And Mr. Allen Brain to argue for the appellant.
All right.
May it please the court, Grant Blaze on behalf of Texas Health Harris Methodist Fort Worth Hospital. The arguments that I'm going to be making in my initial statements are going to be applicable to all of the appellants collectively. I'm going to try to get through the issues in this case, and then counsel for Community Blood Center and counsel for Diana Wilson will try to clean up some issues that may have gone unaddressed in my initial comments. The issue in this case is whether or not the plaintiff submitted and tendered a sufficient expert report under Chapter 74. The plaintiff submitted the expert report of a Dr. Arnold Revdell, who is an orthopedic surgeon in Houston, Texas. The issue in this case is whether or not Dr. Revdell met the requirements of Chapter 74 by specifically articulating an applicable standard of care, breach of the standard of care, and causation as it applies to all of the defendants collectively. Also, whether or not Dr. Revdell was qualified to render those opinions as to each of these defendants in the case. It is the defendants and appellants' collective position that Dr. Revdell's report was insufficient on all four grounds. Addressing the issue of the standard.
Are you going to take the position it was not a good faith effort?
Under the definition of good faith effort, under the law, it is our position that it was not a good faith effort. We're not attributing bad motives to the plaintiff as it relates to the expert report, but just that a good faith effort under the law requires that each of those elements be sufficiently addressed so as to provide a fair summary of the opinions of the report as it relates to each defendant. And in this particular case, that did not occur. So yes, it is our position that a good faith effort was not made in this report. And if you look at the report, I believe it's self-evident in the sense that what Dr. Revdell essentially tries to do, he tries to articulate a standard of care as to all three collective defendants. He does not specifically identify separate standards of care as it relates to each. That is improper under the litany of case law, including the Gray case out of Houston. What Dr. Revdell was required to do was to articulate how each defendant, the duties that each defendant had as it relates to that to the plaintiff, and that's not what occurred at all. What he did is this: he attempted to generalize a standard of care applicable to all three. However, he did not explain in his report how all three defendants had the same standard of care. And if you look at the underlying treatment that occurred as it relates to these three defendants, that just cannot be the case. You have Dr. Wilson, who was the neurosurgeon, who had essentially nothing to do with what occurred to the bone flap after removal from Mr. Biggers' head. You have the hospital, which essentially was the place where the neurosurgery took place, but not where the bone flap was stored or preserved. And then you have Community Blood Center, where that had no involvement in the removal, and was the place where the bone flap was stored. So all three of these defendants played different roles in how it addressed the bone flap. Yet he attempted to articulate a single standard of care. That's just insufficient and doesn't meet the requirements of Chapter 74. If you look to what a purported standard of care Dr. Revdell in his report then attempted to articulate, he does not specifically point out what each defendant was required to do as it relates to the bone flap. What he essentially said is, you've got this bone flap and you're supposed to take care of it and you're supposed to preserve it. Well, that begs the question. How is each defendant supposed to take care of that bone flap? What is each defendant supposed to do with that bone flap? In his report is silent as to what each defendant is supposed to do with regard to the bone flap. So therefore, he did not articulate what an appropriate standard of care for each defendant is.
Well, I believe he does specifically say that you didn't document what you did, which is, this is below the standard of care. That's on his third paragraph on page four of his report.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe in
that might go to causation, but that is a breach of the standard of care in his report.
Well, and again, there are deficiencies with regard to that attempted articulation of a standard of care as it relates to causation and qualifications. Okay. However, addressing the standard of care issue and the documentation issue, first, he says you need to chart and document, but then he doesn't specifically state who needed to chart and document and what needed to be charted and documented. In one part of his report, he talked about the charting being the collective responsibility of the hospital and the physician, doesn't even address community tissue. But then in another part of the report, when he talks about, okay, what is supposed to be charted, then he places that on Dr. Wilson. But then if you go to a third part of the report, he says, well, I really haven't reviewed all of these reports, and it appears to me that that may or may not matter because we know what happened with the bone flap. It went to community tissue. So as far as an articulation of a standard of care, again, there's a failure to separately identify what should have been done by each defendant. Essentially what you have here, Your Honor, is speculation. We don't know what happened to the bone flap. Dr. Ravdell does not know what happened to the bone flap. Nobody will ever know what happened to the bone flap. We don't know what happened to the bone flap when it was removed from Mr. Bigger's head. We don't know what happened to the bone flap when it was placed in the hands of Harris Fort Worth. And we don't know what happened to the bone flap when it was placed in the hands of community tissue. He's trying to basically infer that negligence must have occurred because somewhere in a record in Cook Children's Medical Center several months later, there was a note that it was unusable. We don't know why it was unusable. We don't know when it became unusable. We don't know how it became unusable. We don't know whether or not proper preservation and storage techniques were applied by Dr. Wilson, by Harris Methodist Fort Worth, or by community blood tissue. We don't know whether or not the proper storage in fact occurred and it became unusable just because sometimes tissue becomes unusable.
And apparently, one could argue all this happened because there was a failure to document what happened.
A failure to document can never be a cause in fact of an actual event. That may reflect events that occurred, but it doesn't actually create the event that occurs. So that's a fatal causation problem in this case. Whether or not Harris Fort Worth, or whether or not Dr. Wilson, or whether or not Community Blood Center documented what occurred with this particular bone flap, there still must have been an actual event that occurred. And in this particular case, we will never know what occurred. And there are also fatal deficiencies.
Before you sit down, I want to go back to Judge McCoy's first question about whether this was a good faith effort. Excluding Texas Health Resources and Harris Methodist Hospital, which I don't think there was a report concerning at all, is it your position that because this was not a good faith effort to provide an expert report, that if this court were to reverse, we shouldn't remand for the court to consider 30 days to cure?
I believe that the Scoresby opinion has effectively addressed that, Your Honor. I believe that since there was, a motion for extension that was presented in the trial court, it's within the discretion of this trial court, but it's my understanding that that is something that the court can allow. Yes.
I'm just trying to find out what you're asking for.
Well, Your Honor, what we're asking for, as it relates to Harris Methodist Hospitals, Inc. and Texas Health Resources, I believe that what you stated was, yes, it's our position that there was no report generated by those defendants. As it relates to the other three defendants, there was an attempt at an expert report. They were mentioned. However, it did not constitute a good faith attempt because it did not meet all of the statutory elements of a report, and therefore, it's within the discretion of this court to allow a remand to give an opportunity to the plaintiff to fix that problem.
Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy.
May it please the court. Your Honors, with respect to Community Tissue Bank, I'd like to focus today's argument on the failure with respect to showing or discussing in the report, four corners of the report, a breach and causation. And what is fatal to both of these elements, which are lacking from the report, are Dr. Ravdell's repeated acknowledgments of factual gaps in the facts. Yet he fills them with his ipse dixit speculation and improper inference stacking ultimately inferring causation on what is essentially a res ipsa argument that because there was a bad outcome or the possibility of a better outcome, that someone had to be at fault.
Well, does it bother you that the reason you can't tell what happened is no one documents? So we can sit around and say, let's not document this, therefore if something goes wrong, nobody can tell what happened.
As to community tissue, I absolutely am bothered by that, Your Honor, because even Dr. Rabdell acknowledges in his report that's the responsibility of the hospital and the surgeons, not of community blood center. I think that there is a standard of care stated as to my client in his report, and that is, he says at page 3, a second full paragraph, that the standard preservation procedures for a bone or tissue bank are basically freezing the tissue and labeling it with the patient's name and type of tissue. That's all he says we have to do. But he doesn't ever say that we did or did not do that. What he does say, and I've counted like 7 times, I have been unable to find documentation about the disposition of the material. It is unclear from the records what was done with the materials. I have not seen documentation that the material was properly prepared and plans for storage and maintenance made. The details are not in the records. But then he just leaps and says, but bad results are common and can happen, but he doesn't give specific medical details that that is what did happen. So I'll point the court to the Taylor v. Fawcett decision out of the Dallas Court of Appeals in 2010. It's 320 Southwest 3rd, 570. And there the court, I think it's very similar facts. There were infections and additional surgeries. And there the court found that there was no facts given by the expert in the four corners concerning the expected number of surgeries and infections that would have occurred in the absence of the alleged negligence. And there was no details or facts about whether the subsequently described infections were new, how they developed or changed, or if they were even related to the lack of the bone flap in this case, Your Honors. Therefore, we would submit on behalf of the Community Blood Services Bank that discussing causation and breach in terms of mere possibilities and breaching the analytical gaps with speculation does not meet the Chapter 74 standard as to Community Blood Services or any of the defendants, for that matter. Thank you, Your Honors. Do you have any questions? Thank you.
May it please the Court. Tim Reynolds for Defendant Diana Wilson. As Mr. Blaze indicated previously, There are separate roles and duties by each of these defendants concerning the surgeries plural, which is significant to the causation element I'll come back to in a moment, the disposition of the bone flap and the handling thereafter. As Mr. Blaze correctly stated, Dr. Rabdell does not point out to this court or the trial court what Dr. Wilson's role was once she physically removes the bone flap and hands it off. He groups all defendants together, Dr. Wilson included, with his conclusory comment that it is the defendant's collective duties to make sure the bone flap is properly sealed, transported, and so on and so forth. We believe his report is lacking in factual detail as to what Dr. Wilson's role would have been in the preservation of that bone flap once it leaves her hands after removal from the young man's body. In fact, Dr. Rabdell states on page 2 of his report, page 99 in the clerk's record, that the bone flap was described as being unusable because it had been improperly stored. Dr. Rabdell tells the court no information, gives the court no details to determine what Dr. Wilson's role was in making sure this bone flap was properly stored. Secondly, the issue of causation. Dr. Rabdell, I believe, makes quantum leaps in connecting this issue with the bone flap with any damages relative to this young man. He admits that there are many factors that go into the subsequent infections, the extent of the trauma, which was severe, the number of surgeries, which was multiple. He says, well, using the original bone flap may have made it less likely. That being said, he tells the court no information about what the artificial flaps that were used or attempted to be used, how they may have increased the infection, why they increased the infection, the number of infections or number of surgeries, rather, that they contend would have been made more likely because of the use of artificial flap as opposed to the original bone flap. We believe his report is conclusory, specifically when it comes to the issue of causation. and that he's unable to provide the court enough factual detail to tell the court, setting aside what happened to Bone Flap, how that proximate caused any damages to this young man. I'm happy to answer questions from the court. Other than that, that's my presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Yes. For purposes of running for office, I wish I had your last name. That would look Bob Brain. That would be great on the ballot.
So. Well,
all right, let's proceed.
Who wants to run for office?
May it please the court.
I ask myself that question regularly, particularly this year.
We believe the trial court was correct and that the trial court should be affirmed.
Well, didn't the trial court almost concede that this expert report was deficient, but the easiest thing to do is to send it to the Court of Appeals and let the Court of Appeals wade through and decide what is missing so that there's only one ruling on that, so when you got 30 days to fix it, you knew what you needed to fix?
Actually, Your Honor, and I've been through this, as the court may imagine, this is the most litigated issue in Texas these days. I believe the trial court was saying that if there were deficiencies, they should be identified by the Court of Appeals, because there is a case out there where the trial court found deficiencies and granted a 30-day extension to make corrections, and then the appellate court found different deficiencies.
That's our court, and I was the author, so I'm really familiar with that. So, I mean, that's exactly why she did what she did, isn't it?
I believe so, but I don't think that that she found any deficiencies. There are suggestions here, and I'm puzzled. And I see this quite a bit, where Mr. Reynolds says that there's no statement of how Dr. Wilson failed to follow standards of care. It's in the report. It's stated specifically, and this is on page 10 of our brief, under standards of care applicable to hospitals and to all surgeons handling tissue or bone material intended to be utilized later in the same patient as in this case, the surgeon or his or her staff or associates must document what steps were taken to preserve the integrity of the tissue, including such things as cleaning, removal of associated traumatized or necrotic tissue, plans for packaging, et cetera.
No, but I think his, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So how does failure to document show any causation for the ultimate injuries in this case? I mean, the failure to document isn't what caused the infection.
That's true in every medical case, and every medical case is driven by the documentation. I'm troubled by the statements that I heard today. We don't know what happened. We will never know. This is not a bailment of a chattel, a car, or even a pet. Or this is a human being. Part of his body has been removed to prevent swelling of the brain, and we're hearing from the appellants that we will never know how this happened. Now, it seems to me to be pretty simple for a surgeon and a hospital and a bone bank, a blood bank that's also a bone bank, to document what is going on with a part of this patient's body.
But you haven't answered my question. You've made an emotional appeal, but you haven't answered my question, and my question is, how is failure to document a cause of the ultimate injury in this case?
Dr. Robdell's report states and refers to medical records later where a surgeon attempting to replace this bone flap documents that it had deteriorated and had been improperly stored according to the medical records. That's all any expert can do in a case like this is rely on the medical records.
Well, actually, what he said is it had become unusable, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
But doesn't that mean that it either wasn't properly prepared, as it's discussed here about cleaning and so forth, or it wasn't properly preserved at minus 18 degrees centigrade, et cetera? And because of their failure to document, and we're hearing you about that, But we don't know what, who was the cause of it. I mean, from the records, because they didn't document it. We're hearing that. But
yes, Your Honor. And
it didn't race ipsa, I don't think. You had it and well, it didn't turn out right, so y'all are at fault. You
know. Another issue that's been in the trial court in this case is what discovery can be done pending an expert report. I'm familiar with a case, I believe, out of this court that says written discovery means written discovery. What I'm getting, though, or what I got in the trial court were contentions that only medical records need be produced. Now, Dr. Robdell was operating at a handicap because he's looking at what we had at the time, which were thousands of pages from the hospital. And among those thousands of pages, no documentation of what was done and with this bone flap, when it was removed, how it was prepared for storage, whether it was cleaned, was there any necrotic tissue? This is all discussed in Dr. Robdell's report. Was there a prophylactic antibiotic administered in association with storage? Which, and that Dr. Robdell discusses that among standards of care applicable to all of the defendants. And I'm a little bit at a handicap. I had a message from my partner who was unable to make it here today for health reasons, but she said that there's a case out there saying that a blood bank is not a healthcare provider. I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but I suspect under the latest Supreme Court decisions where a workers' comp case involving an employee is a healthcare provider, I'm willing to concede that Chapter 74 does apply to the blood bank or the bone bank. And I'm also a little troubled in the submissions before this court that the Scoresby decision was simply overlooked. And I think that all of the cases, including the so-called no-report cases, there's a long line of them, and they're discussed in the Scoresby decision. The no-report cases are cases where the defendant is not even mentioned in the report.
Such as Texas Health Resources and Harris Methodist Hospital, correct?
Well, that is the same entity.
So you want us to just take the leap and assume that?
It's been a while, Your Honor, but I believe when we researched the entities that it's the same entity.
So is it your position that if this court were to reverse this and send it back, that you get another bite at the apple as to them as well?
My recollection is that when we were preparing this case and issuing the citations, that I had a conversation with a lawyer for that entity, and I was told that it's all the same entity. It's all the hospital. Now, that may not be true, but that's what I was told by counsel for the hospital. So they're a named defendant, but they're the same entity. So it's one of those corporate things. And it's referred to as the hospital repeatedly in Dr. Robdell's report. And another issue here, and I'm hearing this increasingly in challenges to expert reports, is whether the report needs to be so specific as to outline everything that needs to be done or should have been done. And Dr. Robdell's report is clear that the risk of infection in synthetic material is 5 times greater. I don't believe that there's any jurisprudence suggesting that an expert report has to be consistent with Daubert-Robinson. But down the road, if there's a Daubert-Robinson challenge, that issue can be addressed after discovery is done.
Well, let's just for a moment assume, and I'm not speaking for anybody, including myself, but let's just assume we send it back. What are you going to do? I mean, I gather that you have obtained all of the records that you've sought, and how are you going to address the problems of separate standards of care, separate acts of negligence, and separate causation issues?
Well, the standards are all the same, according to Dr. Rob Dell, and the standards are all the same.
I can't believe that the standard of care for somebody that's preserving this bone flap sent to them by the hospital is the same standard of care as the person that's preparing it to send to the bone flap preserving entity. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, this person over here is supposed to clean it and examine it and whatnot and so forth, and these people over here are supposed to freeze it and hold it and make sure the temperature stays something. That's not the same standard of care.
Well, the preparation of the material certainly was the hospital and the surgeon's
right
role.
Right.
The proper storage of the material is the blood bank's role.
That's not the same role, so it's not the same standard of care.
Well, it's
but
it's
back to my question. What are you going to do if we send it back and say this report is insufficient?
By that time, I will have, I anticipate, some answers to written discovery directed to the defendants. And okay, those would be like interrogatories and requests for production, which have already been promulgated, although I don't believe we've done interrogatories. But obviously, in a situation where I'm hearing now that we don't know what happened, we will never know, I think that a doctor or a hospital or a blood bank, a bone bank, any entity, to suggest that they can escape liability for negligence by not making any records. Suppose a surgeon does a surgery and just doesn't want to write an operative report. Would that be acceptable in today's world? I don't think that storing part of a patient's body in a manner where we're hearing later we can't tell what happened to this piece of this patient's skull is acceptable in today's world. And I think that's what Dr. Rob Dell's report basically states. And he does implicate in his report all of the defendants. And once again, my understanding is that Harris Methodist Hospitals, Inc., Texas Health Harris Methodist Fort Worth, and Texas Health Resources are the same entity. So I don't believe it's a situation where there is no report as to any entities. Now, another issue on qualifications. Dr. Rob Dell has been a doctor for over 50 years, and he states clearly in his report his familiarity with handling tissues of this kind as an orthopedic surgeon. I don't believe that he has to write a treatise on this issue. I think that the failure to prepare and store this material properly is clear from his report. He relies on medical records, which is all any expert can do, unless he's actually a treating doctor. And even then, because doctors see so many patients, when they're trying to describe what happened to a patient, what do they rely on? Their own records. So every case like this is driven by the records, and that's what Dr. Rob Dell is relying on.
Well, doesn't Dr. Rob Dell in his expert report say, in this case, hundreds pages of records from the hospital are available for review, and most are reviewed, looking for the pertinent information? I have not seen that documentation, but it may not be pertinent, as it may only show details of when the material was received, checked out for evaluation, if that was done, and removed for use in restorative surgery. I mean, these are all very conclusory statements, are they not? Even on the documentation issue, he said most are reviewed. I have not seen, I have not found. He never says, I looked at every page and it's not there.
Well, the reality is that when you have thousands of pages of medical records and you're working with a consultant and he is going through the records, I can't control what he says about what he reviews. But if there was some kind of documentation of what happened here, I'm sure we would know about it by now. Instead, what we're hearing is that we will never know. So I think it's been conceded by the defendants that there is no documentation of what was done with this material, because otherwise we wouldn't be hearing this statement, "We will never know." So that may not be the most articulate description of Dr. Robdell's review, and that certainly can be revised to reflect that he reviewed all the documents available, because he did, and we had them on a flash drive for him. And despite his being a little older doctor, he was able to deal with the technology, and he found no records and no documentation of what was done. And when you are dealing with something like this, very sensitive material which is prone to deterioration if not handled properly, I think it's not unreasonable to expect a hospital, a neurosurgeon, and a blood bank to have some documentation of what was going on with this material. Now, suppose there is a power outage at the blood bank, or suppose there's a catastrophe, a flood, or a tornado or something. Wouldn't there be some kind of documentation of what happened to the material like this?
All right, counsel, a tornado has come down and turned your light off, so you're out of time. Thank you.
Thank you.
This must be going to be pretty brief if there's three of you.
I'm going to try to see if I can just hit the highlights. I think there's an issue here with regard to the documentation that the court is struggling with, and let me see if I can kind of put some of these matters straight. First of all, this whole case arises because there's a notation somewhere in the Cook's Children's Medical Center records that the flap become unusual because of improper storage. Okay. We don't know who wrote that. It was not written by a neurosurgeon. Dr. Sebastian in Houston just referenced that note. Even under the Collini case out of this court, if you're going to rely upon that medical record for the underlying or ultimate fact that this bone flap was unusable due to improper storage, the individual who wrote that note has to be established as qualified to render that opinion.
Well, somebody didn't use it. There's the fact.
Well, there
they
are.
Didn't use the flap.
There are a myriad of reasons why you wouldn't use a flap, and most of them are based upon just the natural medical issues that arise when you're talking about a craniostomy.
Okay, so where are you going with, we don't know who wrote that, so what?
Because there's a presupposition that the bone flap was not properly stored based upon a notation in a medical record that nobody knows who wrote.
Of course, he can't find out who wrote it because he can't take a deposition.
Well, Your Honor, here's the bottom line on that. Chapter 74 says what it says, and we have to deal with what Chapter 74 says. And as it relates to the documentation issue, there are circumstances where lack of a documentation can support a cause of action under Chapter 74, especially when you're talking about failing to document a high blood pressure or failing to document some sort of hemorrhage, and then therefore the subsequent treaters fail to act upon the lack of documentation. So there's not an ipso facto, hey, failure to document never provides a cause of action under Chapter 74. But in this particular case, what you're doing is basically just documenting a fact. We know for a fact that the bone flap was removed. We know for a fact that the bone flap was presented to community tissue for storage, and we know for a fact that it stayed there, and we know for a fact that it got to Cook Children's Medical Center. We don't know what ultimately resulted in the failure to use the bone flap, but there are several reasons why it could have not been used. One, it could have deteriorated on its own in the absence of negligence. Material can still become compromised. Also, because of the nature of this man's underlying injuries, it may or may not have been wise to put it in at the time. There are a lot of reasons that we'll never know. But as it relates to the documentation, this is where he failed to articulate an applicable standard of care as it related to all three healthcare providers. You cannot expect, and it would make no sense for the medical records of Harris Methodist of Fort Worth to contain the preservation procedures that took place at Community Blood Bank. It would also make no sense for Community Blood Bank to document what occurred at Harris Methodist Fort Worth. This report is silent as to what, in essence, was supposed to have taken place in the documentation, except for the note that Justice Gabriel wrote earlier that said, basically, in the medical records, you're going to see that the bone flap was removed, the bone flap was given to community tissue. We know that occurred. So any lack of documentation as to whether or not a prophylactic was used or whether or not it was stored in a cup versus a bag, whether or not it was stored at minus 18 degrees centigrade versus minus 20 degrees centigrade, those are all issues, one, that we will never know, but at the same time, you can't impute the liability of each and every defendant to a supposed conduct on the part of another defendant. And that's where we have a problem with this report. He basically is making an assumption that the bone flap was unusable because of negligence. That's based upon a medical record by somebody who has not established the qualifications necessary to render that opinion. And then he's saying, because of that, all of these three defendants must have been negligent. But he doesn't articulate, Dr. Wilson, here's what you should have done, here's what you did, here's why that's negligence, and here's why that negligence caused the damages that we're claiming. He didn't do that for all three defendants. And as it relates to the qualifications, Dr. Abdel is an orthopedic surgeon. This involves neurosurgery. While Dr. Ravdell may have been involved in peer reviews, while Dr. Ravdell may have knowledge with regard to removal of bone tissue in the orthopedic world, this is not a surgical issue. This is a tissue storage and preservation issue that Dr. Ravdell, in his report, has not established his qualifications to render an opinion on. Doctors in the surgical suite may remove the tissue, and then they hand it off. They never see what happens to that tissue after they hand it off. They're not leaving the sterile field. This case involves what happens after that tissue leaves the sterile field. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you for your very well-written briefs and oral argument. Your case is submitted, and now we're going to take a break until 10:30, at which time we'll hear the third oral argument case for today.